Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host and passionate lover of poetry and all the ecstatic powers it brings, Mikala Ann. This week, we are welcoming guest Phil English, Goldramader, diviner, and Thelemite, to come onto the podcast and chat about the poetic and primordial power of working and expressing the runes. We chat poetry, singing, enchanting, and the importance of cultivating right relations with the mythopoetic narratives inside us. Certainly a treat for anyone interested in the history of traditions, and more so in the way we weave stories and songs of the living and dead in syncopations of unity and frenzied sound, a co-creation with all around us. What are the runes? Who is Odin? Why is it so hard to reconstruct a firm proof of praxis for a people whose histories and myth interpretations have been destroyed and forgotten? Why might it be better to engage in these myths as living narratives instead of historiographical proof of such and such a thing? What are some of the mysteries of enchantment and disenchantment? And most importantly, why is it so necessary to ground ourselves in the reality of the histories of oppression as tactics to keep ourselves ethical and humble in our magic practice? All this and more in today's episode of Saturn Vox. Don't forget to check out the Patreon-exclusive episode, which features Phil telling his own mythopoetic understanding of a few of the runes, as well as a bit more commentary on weaving narratives of poetry and power in our own lives. To find more on Saturn Vox, check out their Instagram and Twitter at Saturn Vox, or visit their website www.saturnvox.com. If you want to support the show towards goals of better equipment, merch, and bonus material, please check out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/saturnvox, where one can join in on our book club and Discord communities.
I'm Phil English. I am a Goldramader, which is a fancy Old Norse way of saying that I work the projective magic of runes, specifically singing and chanting and carving them to affect change in the world. I am one of the original founders of Catland Books. I think that's what I'm most well known for as far as the famous thing that we did. And I am also a Thelemite and Western Hermeticist, but I tend to focus on runes and Nordic traditions as the expression of my magical soul, if you will. And in doing that, I do work as a diviner primarily, and then also what I like to call a sorcerer for hire. Though I tend to do a lot more divination than sorcery.
Oh, lovely. That's quite a repertoire. A lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
We're going to try to get to all of it. But I definitely want to start. Oh my gosh, this is so... All this rune stuff and how the rune stuff works is a little bit foreign to me, just because it's not something that I personally have ever worked with. But oh my gosh, I love what you're saying, singing the runes. Like, Right. Do you sing at them while you carve them? Are you like singing poems from the Eddas? So I know theoretically Yeah. Each rune has a poem.
Right, and those aren't necessarily from the Eddas, and then there's multiple poems. But to get to the core of your question, like, what do you do? Like, what do you mean you sing? Gosh, I do all of the above. And it's a big topic, and it's hard to know where to start on, like, what are runes? Why would you sing them? How does that work? They have names. The names have associations that are, I would call, like, mnemonics, going back maybe 1,000 years now, at least, that we have a basic chain of mnemonic wisdom. Some of that is documented in various poems. So you have, and I don't have my sources in front of me, so I want to be cautious not to date things and out myself as not a good historian, but you have the Old English rune poem, the I think the Old Norse rune poem, we have the Icelandic rune poem, and then there's some recent work around later, and these are from I think pre-modern history, so still kind of like just coming out of the Viking Age is when they become codified. So if I were to guess, and I may be wrong in the history here because I'm just going off the top of my head, but I would guess in the sort of, you know, somewhere between the 9th century and 10th century is when we start getting the poems with the meanings of the runes associated poetically. And we also have, I think, a 17th century Swedish rune poem that an academic that I follow and will be citing a lot, Dr. Rune Hjarno Rasmussen, really did work to sort of uncover and popularize, which is agricultural poems associated with the calendar. And he does work around runic calendars, which is not something I specialize in, but you have histories of specifically Scandinavian peoples, like in these cases, often like Christian or post-Christian cultured peoples, marking seasons and days and like doing solely lunar calendars with runes, and then having poems that are divinatory, expressly divinatory in meaning, about, you know, if this season is marked, say, by the Isa rune, the ice rune, that you will have, you'll have, say, you know, like a bad harvest. And so the runes to me are, well, I want to back up for a moment. One, to give credence to historians and give due credit to historians and archaeologists and anthropologists that I follow and study, because I think they're very important. Some of them are practitioners, some of them are not. By practitioners, I mean believers, pagans, and some of them are you know, pretty hardline atheists. And their work informs mine, but I'm not an academic. So I'm a religious person working magic in the world, and my religion happens to be highly informed by specifically pre-Christian Nordic traditions. And so I'll just name folks so I don't have to keep citing them. I think these are people who you can find online also. It's Dr. Matthias Nordvig, Maria Fjellhaug, who did a brilliant master's thesis on kind of initiatory themes in Eddic poetry, called The Maiden with the Mead. I already mentioned Dr. Rune Hjarno Rasmussen, and then Dr. Neil Price, who is not a practitioner, who wrote, I think, a PhD thesis called The Viking Way. I could be wrong on that, but I think that's what it's called. But it was later kind of rewritten in a popularized mass market form called The Children of Ash and Elm. And he advised on that film, The Northmen, which I think it's great. It was very much a fantasy, but it's great. And the reason I say this before answering your question is because I think there's a problem of modern Nordic pagan streams, whether that be Asatru, which is kind of like the organized modern religion side of things, or like heathenry in general, or even just people who are really into Vikings and reenactment, that we've inherited a lot of kind of wonky ideas that are ahistorical, which is not necessarily bad or wrong, but that can lead people to be trapped in what I consider like fantasy, and in some cases glamour, right? So a detachment from the world as it truly is, and a detachment from the ground of reality. And I guess the reason I'm going on this rant is because my magic is all about approaching the truth and approaching reality. And in many cases, I mean, depending on if I'm going to a nightclub or not, right? So I was about to say, like, dispelling glamour and illusion, but I won't lie, like, I will embrace that if I want to look really, really hot at goth night.
Feels.
Yeah, like, but outside of that context, like, why would I chant runes, right? To be in touch and be closer to the underlying phenomena that creates reality. And that being said, I try to ground myself in as much historical praxis as I can. And by historical, I mean, what do we really know, like, about runic magic? And the sources are kind of scant and hard to dig through, but they do exist. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned poetry, because the primary, like, documents that form modern reconstructions of Nordic religion and magical practice, most of it is poetic in nature, and most of it makes a lot more sense. So I'm not fully fluent in Old Norse, but I try my best to sit with, like, my grammar and my dictionary, and when I'm reading, I can read with some degree of fluency Old Norse. My pronunciation is terrible. I'm from Central Florida, and I speak with I was raised by an old Southern lady, my grandma, so I speak with her old timey accent, and I try speaking Old Norse with a Southern accent. It's its own messed up thing. So I do my best, but reading source materials, reading the poetry in the intended language, opens up different avenues and vistas of understanding. And so for me, poetry and song and chanting poems and chanting song and the vibratory process of like finding the right incantation, finding the right rune to resonate for the moment that you want to have and want to express and want to understand more deeply, or finding some phenomena that you want to come into contact with and to get to the core of, like, what it's really about. For me, the best way to do that, at least in my own experience, is to, like, embrace the poetry of it, embrace the musicality of it, and to, like, let rip and to chant it. And I find myself at odds a lot with a lot of, especially English-speaking Viking reenactment or Nordic pagan culture, because I find that many people, especially if they aren't really looking at things in the original language, are missing the forest for the trees with the poetry, right? So I believe that people, pre-Christian Scandinavian people, were a lot more in tune to the metaphor and the poetry of their religion.
Yeah. I'm surprised by that, just because, well, I'm not involved in any sort of community of people who do, like, heathenry, paganry, right, besides Thelemites, which is that pagan? We can ask that question a bit later.
Oh, yeah. I'll be happy to get into that.
Yes, I hope so. But I guess to me, it's like, okay, well, Odin is, like, god of poetry, and right, Odin I do know the story of the runes and how he, like, you know, or, okay, I'm lying. I'm having stories mixed in my head because I've read them once, but I know he drank mead, won poetry, hung himself on a tree, and, like, learned the language of the spirits, which is basically what runes are. And if spirits are liminal creatures, poetry would be the only way to express that. So it's all these myths of Odin together. I mean, not his warlord myths. That's a different issue entirely. But as a person who's not involved, it, like, seems obvious to me that poetry would be a large part of it.
Yeah. And I think to some extent it is, but I think people understand that he's a god of poetry. What I think they miss often, I'm not saying everybody, but I think it's common in modern, especially English-speaking Nordic pagan communities, is they miss the fact that it's implicit, that it's a metaphor, right? They miss the fact that the religious expression, it's implicit that this is a poetic process. And you end up getting a lot of, I'll give you an example, like debates about the reification of lore on Tumblr or like how many legs, debates about how many legs Odin's horse has, right?
Well, yeah, in one person's dream it'll be 12, and in another person's dream it'll be 16.
Right. And this leads to a broader question, which is if our sources came from poems that were codified hundreds of years after the fact, which is the case, right? So we're looking primarily at the poetic and prose Eddas, so the Edda of Sæmund the Wise, and then the great corpus of reconstructed Nordic paganism would be coming from Snorri Sturluson, who wrote things down in I think the 13th century, which is a number of centuries after the Viking Age ended.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't he Christian?
Yeah, he was. In some sense, if I'm not mistaken, he was Catholic. That opens a whole other discussion about, well, what does it mean to be really Christian?
Well, the history of English magic and Norse magic and Christianity all butting heads right there is such an interesting time period to me. Mm-hmm.
And I love to point this out, right? Because the runes existed long prior to the Viking Age. I'm just not that into Vikings. I think they're really cool, but my religion is not one of reconstructing Viking religion. it's experiencing the divinity that's revealed to me through the runes. And the runes existed before the Vikings. The runes seem to have existed before what we would consider that codified idea of a exoteric pre-Christian Nordic religion where there's a civil cult. And then they continue to exist and be used and widely used well after the so-called Christianization of Scandinavia as well. And they made their way into England. They migrated from the continent into Scandinavia, then migrated their way back out into England and Northern Europe.
Yeah. You know what that's making me think of?
What's that?
I mean, we have no way to prove this, obviously, but as you were weaving that story, I was thinking about, you know, cuneiform writing and the form of writing that we have from Sumeria originates from, you know, wanting to keep track of data.
Yeah.
Like, how much grain do we have? How many people are there? It was all bureaucratic and they needed a way to keep up with ledgers. What about, like, this lost animist society that perhaps invented writing as a form of, you know, mythic co-relationship with nature, as opposed to some sort of bureaucratic system? And, like, I don't know. I mean, again, this is, like, unanswerable questions, but when you're talking about runes as poetry and their society and religion being very mythopoetic in nature, it would make sense to me if there was at one point a divine impetus to like imprint the symbols I'm seeing in these ecstatic states and like give name to them.
Oh, right. Yeah. And to get back to the myth of Odin winning the runes, which you mentioned earlier, in relation to that idea, something that I find beautiful about runes as a system of magic is that no god made them, right? Like Odin doesn't make the runes and give them to us. Odin it has an existential crisis and wants more wisdom than is available to him as a deity, and essentially invokes his own right, like asks, what happens when people want wisdom? They sacrifice to me. I will sacrifice myself to myself for more wisdom. Does so hanging outside the world tree, outside the limitations of the known universe, and then falls and screaming grasps the runes out there in the greater void. And so the runes are just out there and exist outside of the like the creative scheme of gods. And when we look at runes as there's a way to look at them as encapsulating a cosmology and a cosmogony. If you look at them in order, this is ahistoric. This is magical knowledge, right? Starting with Feyu, the cattle and the Nordic creation myth with Audumbla, the great cow representing abundant fertility and cosmic fertility, and making its way in through 24 runes in the Elder Futhark, describing a universe, right? These are the building blocks of the world as we know it. There are runes for gods and the gods, and runes for humans, right? So we're sort of on equal footing with the divine. And then in the Eddas, Odin has runes, various gods have runes, various classes of spirits have runes, dwarves and elves have runes, and humans have runes. And I like that it's a magical technology that we're all using, right? So that that I have runes, but also the gods are working rune magic too.
No, I love this. This is a profound mystery you're talking about. This is like the code behind the veil that even the gods need to like petition to have access to.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love about Odin as the archetypal magician god is that he resorts to magical means to get knowledge outside of his purview. And often that looks like necromancy. So in like the Völuspá, Frigg, his wife, has a dream that is prophetic in nature about the death of their son. And she essentially asks him, what do you think this means? And the narrative is basically, he's like, I don't know. Let's summon a dead witch to give us knowledge, right? And this is the setup. It's the setup for a cosmological poem, because they summon the shade of an ancient witch goddess who may or may not be connected to Freya. And he's like, tell me what this dream means, but to prove that you have the necessary wisdom to interpret it, also tell me the history of the cosmos first. Like, show me the history of the cosmos first, and then we can interpret this dream. Then I'll believe that you have the means to do that in a necromantic way.
Oh, there's
rite.
That trickster.
Yeah. And then you get the Völuspá, which is a cosmological poem. So then she is like, okay, well, here's what happened at the beginning, and here are the classes of spirits who existed and their names.
Oh my gosh. Well, I love that from the perspective of, you know, a magician myself, because it's like, yeah, like who better to ask questions about the mysteries than like those more actively involved? Like, what's the point of doing magic if I can't like call the spirit of the wind to like teach me how it moves messages from A to B?
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. And I love, as somebody who feels particularly devoted to Odin as a god, I love the limited nature of Odin in that sense, or at least in those stories, because it's like, okay, Odin's wife has this dream and wants knowledge on it, and he's basically like, I don't know, I guess we have to summon a dead witch. Like, okay, that's your recourse. Okay.
So what I find so interesting about that is I would say the way that you keep emphasizing, like, I'm not reconstructing history, like, I'm involved in actively trying to utilize the magical technology in the same way that Odin did, like, teach me the mysteries, teach me how to use this, teach me how to work with this, and in return, I, you know, devote myself to you for the wisdom.
Yeah.
But it's more about this drive to create with the universe than it is to, like, prove that you've reconstructed the, you know, absolutely adequate one-to-one synonymous, you know, religion of your ancestors.
Right. And that's a really beautiful way of describing my approach. I mean, you've summarized my ideals better than I could. And I'm glad this is recording, so I'm going to go back and write that down and be like, yes, that's what I'm doing. And that's my general aim. When I was 19 years old, I had a spiritual experience that changed the trajectory of my life. I was raised in a Nordic pagan, quasi-reconstructed household. So my dad is a hippie, and I don't want to inflate what it looked like. In the 90s, my household looked like Wicca, but reskinning Wicca with the Norse gods, if that makes sense. Like, we didn't have very good historical sources. The internet wasn't what it is now, and we didn't have access to it.
No, totally. Because wasn't Wicca heathenry kind of the response to neo-paganism? Just, well, some of us are doing it with Greek gods and some of us are doing it with Norse gods, so let's just call ourselves heathens and
right.
Move on.
Yeah, that's what it felt like in the 90s as a kid. Except I was also being given the line that this is the reconstructed true old religion of our ancestors, right? Which isn't true. And then as an adolescent, I got online and started reading, because it was very lonesome as well. That was not a popular thing. We didn't have bands like Heilung and Vordruna and TV shows like Vikings or Instagram going on with, we didn't have Vikinggram, right? So I was a kid in Central Florida with this weird dad. And that being said, it was my religion growing up, and I'd been doing runes since I was 9. But I got a little bit disillusioned in my teens because I read better sources and said, oh, that's not, a lot of what I thought was traditional was made up by some guy in Lansing, Michigan in the 70s, stuff like that, where it was like, oh, some disaffected Southern Baptists got together and decided they would make a new church, but make it Viking. And then when I was 19 years old, I had a peak experience, like an actual mystical experience, which led me to kind of affirm to myself that, okay, this looks like Gnosticism for me. I'm definitely not an atheist nor an agnostic. I'm the opposite. I am a Gnostic, where I spontaneously in bed in the morning one day in my late teens just found myself leaving my body and coming face to face with Odin, right? Like, I don't have good words for it, because it was a mystical experience. It was like, oh, I now have total beyond faith knowledge of the truth of the divine, because I'm getting to glimpse Odin, who is God, right? And I came back from that and felt like very invigorated, but I will say decades out from it, where I've had many deep spiritual experiences, but that was the only time I've been like, yes, I know for certain, right? Like I know this is truth. Yeah. There is some truth in the universe. But having had that very personal Gnostic mystical experience, I came back and felt as though I'd been given marching orders to be a magician. And so Odin being a god of magic, I felt like, okay, I've been shown this, and now my life is about doing the magic and learning the magic and expressing the magic. And to that extent, like magic is my religion. Magic is what I'm here to do and to work. It's why I exist. And a side effect of that is, I think aesthetically and historically, I find Viking stuff really interesting and really fascinating, but I don't want to be a Viking, right? Like I don't want to live as Vikings lived. I don't want to reconstruct Viking ethos. And that gets into kind of the dichotomy between the magic I'm working, which I view as a way of getting closer to the truth and the fundamental reality of the world, and the glamour of Viking stuff, because it's very alluring, and there's a modern aesthetic and a whole Instagram rabbit hole you can go down of people painting runes on their face and wearing beautiful furs and shaking swords around, and I think that's wonderful aesthetically and as almost kind of a expression of like nerddom. Like I like that stuff, but when it starts to be conflated with the more mystical or religious aspects of what I'm doing, I find that it's not necessarily helpful, because I'm a person existing here and now in 2023, and I want to be mindful, and I encourage people who are interested in what I'm doing or learning, who are interested in learning runes from me or getting a reading from me, to know how to delineate between spiritual and magical truth and spiritual and magical experiences and fantasy or mm-hmm. entertainment, and those things can overlap, but if they begin to overlap a lot, it can cause kind of a it can cause people to get lost, I think, from their way, right? They can cause people to get, in Thelemic terms, I think it can divert people from their true will, because we incarnated here and now in this world, and the ethos that I have taken from the Viking spirit, right? Even if we want to go back to the idea of like the confrontational macho parts of that, which is what really turns me off, right? The macho stuff is where I'm like, oh, I don't want to hang out with barbarians. Like I don't want you to shake an axe at me, man. Like I get it, you're a badass, cool. Yeah, I get it, you lift. I think that I think that it can distract, right? That fantasy can distract from the real spirit, which is confronting reality, confronting your life as it is here, and the battles that we fight need to be based in Midgard, right? So we need to fight battles in our own lives, so that we can express ourselves to the fullest of our potential. And I think that takes being rooted and grounded in the here and the now.
Oh my goodness. Wow. I loved that so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes. I think Oh, it's so hard sometimes because, of course, the glamour is alluring, but then it's like what is beyond the glamour is almost in a way terrifying. And the way that society is like set up is to keep us trapped in the glamour so that we don't sit with the uncomfortable feelings or like the uncomfortable reality. And that keeps us, you know, detached from our power. And I mean, you know this as a Thelemite. Like I think about the Hanged Man card a lot being associated with Pisces and the way that Crowley had Freda Harris draw it in the Thoth deck is like with the Hanged Man's head is suspended in primordial water. It's like alchemically, it is pure, like Platonic ideal water, which is the mystery. You know, it is the liminal. It is that primordial space of life and death.
Right.
And you have to kind of just let go and suspend yourself in it, which means allowing those uncomfortable feelings to move through you. When you're chasing the glamour, you're actually attempting to like grasp at the water, which is why I think it's so poignant that in Crowley's version, his hands are nailed down. Like he can't grab. He can only experience the emotional liminality of the situation.
Right. Yeah, that's really astute.
Do you have like advice on how to do this? Like I feel like it's hard to put into words, but if you could try, that would be amazing.
Yeah. So doing this being doing stuff with runes, is that your...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. How do you allow yourself that tether to Midgard as you descend or ascend into either of the, you know, various other kingdoms?
That's a really good question. I want to start with just looking at the word glamour first, because I think it's important. And it's an important word. I've used the word illusion a lot, or like, I think Maya is a good word to be syncretic. But my understanding of the etymology of the word glamour, and this could be up for debate, I'm not an academic, but if I understand correctly, it comes from an old Norse word, which translates to glam's sight. And glam is a dead shepherd, a revenant ghost from a saga called Grettir's Saga. And Grettir is the anti-hero protagonist of that saga, and he's hired to clear a field of a violent ghost called Glam. And Glam curses Grettir, and Grettir becomes afraid of the dark, and his vision fails him, and he falls from his sort of task and mission in life. He kind of deviates from his will in the world. And so I think it's worth going back, if you're interested in the runes, looking at that story and thinking about the etymology of like, well, what is glamour? And if that etymology holds true, then glamour is a curse. And glamour is the kind of curse that affects your vision, affects your ability to see the world for what it is, and gets you to deviate from your own heroism, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And how to approach that? I think one, do some magic about it, right? Like, like break that fucking curse.
If you know its name, you have its power.
Yeah, I won't give step-by-step tips on how to do that. But divine, right? Do runes, read runes. If you don't know how, don't let other people define them for you. Look at the poems, understand what you're dealing with, and as safely as possible, because I don't think that runes are inherently safe. I wouldn't start putting them on things if you don't know what you're doing. I wouldn't get a rune tattoo, but approach the runes and actually engage with them, right? Not aesthetically. Don't just start an Instagram account where you're painting them on stuff and declaring yourself a runic priest or priestess, right? Engage with them in your life. And I will say that they tend to want to teach themselves to people, right? So working through runes, finding runes that resonate with you, putting them down on paper, learning what you can about them, chanting their names, their proto Germanic names, and saying, show me the truth of you, right? Show me your truth, and allowing those mysteries to unfold for you in your life outside of the context of Vikings or Nordicness, right? Looking at them as universal mysteries, that helps. And I think that that can help people grow in wisdom. And then that's like a flower that I think will unfold. And those are skills that are necessary for going to other zones, going to other worlds, and experiencing other spiritual planes, and being able to make something meaningful of them to bring them back to your life and the circumstances of your incarnation, so that you can experience like the heroism of being Mikala or being Philip, right? As opposed to being a made up Viking name that I found on the internet.
Oh man, I love this. Especially because they are like, you know, little stories within stories themselves. And then if they are the primordial elements that make up the phenomenal world that we experience, then like you can just use them to reprogram or just to teach.
Right.
Okay. So I'm backing up a bit because I got excited.
Okay.
And I get creatively excited sometimes about magic. But so if you are a person that doesn't know anything about the runes yet, it sounds like what you're saying is it doesn't even I don't know if you should go out and buy a set of runes, just wait and like call them at an altar one by one and carve them one by one as you're getting to know them. Like, what is the process here?
You feel me? I would recommend the carving more than the buying. The buying is okay, but traditionally you want to find wood that's borne fruit from a tree that's borne fruit. And you take that wood and you carve the runes in it. And then if you're feel comfortable doing so and could do so safely, traditionally we would stain it with our own blood, right? I wouldn't recommend people going overboard with that. I don't think that's a 100% requirement, but if you wanted to do the big ritual, right, that's what I would do. But
you gotta give it life.
I would be but it should be your own. People who menstruate, it's easier for them than people who don't. It's the only time I envy people who menstruate, because I'm for being somebody who's in a tradition that involves drawing your own blood, I'm extremely squeamish and wimpy about doing that. And so when I do it very rarely, and when I do it, when I'm going to stain runes with blood, I sit and it takes me hours with a lancet, because I poke myself just little bits, and something in me is something, some very wimpy part of me goes like, "Ooh, no, don't do it." And then I have to like really work into it. So as I say that, I want to be mindful to be like, I don't always practice what I preach. I'm wimpy about it. And it's the only time I'm like, you know, that would be a benefit of menstruation. Just to have easier access. Well, maybe not easier. I don't know. I don't know what it feels like.
No, I mean, like, you know, I've got a whole cup of it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
I would be remiss if I don't self-promote. I teach, right? I teach runes, especially because I've seen so many mishaps with runes. because they're powerful. If you put them on something, regardless of your understanding of its meaning, that meaning will manifest. And I've seen so many explosions and literal fires and chaotic and sometimes even violent events happen as people will put a rune on an object, assuming it will bring a blessing when in fact it brings something else. So I teach for that reason.
When the blessing and the curse are the same thing.
Yeah. And what I try to teach is methods for people to come into contact with the mysteries of the runes themselves. So I'm not big on teaching meaning. I'm big on teaching history. Like, here's what we know historically, citing the aforementioned academics and saying, look, this is what we've proven based on the record. and here are some theories around what archaeological finds mean. And here's my experience as a magician, integrating that knowledge and interacting with it in a modern spiritual and magical context. So I offer that to students semi-regularly through my website, and sometimes I just talk to people in private. In divination, sometimes there's people that are not necessarily interested in runes, but there's a particular rune that will come through as like, this is like an ally, and this is something that you need to have on an altar for a set amount of time, right? And to engage with it that way. So it can come up through divination. But if somebody's just like, I want to get into runes, I would read the poems first and just meditate on them. And as a syncretic magician, I think it's completely valid and probably a better path to go down to think about things in the astral plane or even in guided meditation sense to visualize runes and start to get in touch with them that way before putting them down on actual objects. I feel like that was an elaborate way of getting around to your question. So I hope that answered it okay.
Oh, no, that was a beautiful answer. Well-rounded. I love this idea of, because I keep going back to, it only clicked for me recently how watery Odin was. I don't know, maybe it's just because I've never actually put much attention to him.
Right.
Even though I have, you know, some, but it was really, again, like while I was thinking about the Hanged Man card and Saturn about to go into Pisces and Odin's association with Saturn and like everything that you're talking about here, even this like idea of getting to know the runes through like meditation and then write it down, is this like water, then Saturn, like water above, then Earth, you know? And I don't know. I there's no question there. It's just like, it's all just like tickling a part of me that's like curious, I guess.
Well, can you tell me more about your water associations with Odin? So I cannot not see Odin and the Hanged Man card, especially the Toth Hanged Man card. And then you also have Mem, the Hebrew letter associated with that card, which I believe is also a watery letter. But I'd love to hear more about kind of your perception of Odin and how that developed as an association with water, and especially the Saturn and Saturnine elements too. I tend to think of Ymir, the Jotun that Odin slayed to craft the phenomenal world. I tend to think of Ymir as more Saturnine and Odin as more something like a mercurial Jupiterian at the intersection of Mercury and Jupiter. But I can see all of the above as valid.
Yes. And I think that's like one of the things that I think is good to note as a person who's like playing with syncretism.
Yeah.
Is like, they would not have had a planetary associations.
Right.
So when we try to shoehorn planetary associations onto deities that wouldn't have otherwise had them, especially, you know, in in the Norse pantheon, I've noticed it can be very muddy. Like, obviously, there's a mercurial aspect to Odin because of his trickster nature. And I see the Jupiter somewhat, but I mean, again, I'm not super well versed in Norse mythology. So, but to me, like, Thor would be more the Jupiter, like the jovial one.
Yeah. And we do have those associations with the days, right? So Thursday is Jupiter's day, is Thor's day.
Yeah. And Freya being Friday.
Right. Yeah. And then you get associations kind of put on by the Roman world and Tacitus. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Maybe it's Tacitus. It's the problem of being autodidactic. And then there's later... there's a strange thing that happens in sort of the later Viking Age and then the earlier kind of 13th century Nordic canonization of the poems, where associations do come in. So you have the old Icelandic poem for the rune Thurisaz, which Thurisaz is a specific class of Jotuns that are typically considered malefic. And the poem translates to Thurs, or giant, is torturer of women and cliff dweller and husband of a giantess and Saturn's thane, right? So there's a reference to Saturn there in the poems. And the poems exist in a Christian context. So the Hellenic world was known from the point of view of the Nordic countries at that point. So there is some overlap, but it doesn't like spring forth natively, completely synchronized with the Kabbalistic tree of life.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the more I think about it, the more I'm like, okay, well, if Freya is pure Venus and Thor is pure Jupiter,
yeah,
why is Odin not pure Mercury? Like, right. he's not. And maybe that is a part of his deeper mystery, that he somehow can wear the cloaks of all the planets.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the Allfather.
And I have a strong knee-jerk reaction to hearing Freya is Venus, because everything that I understand about Freya, both from sources and then from my own religious experiences, that Freya is a goddess of sex and death, and love has very little to do with it.
And is
very, very, there's carnality. There's this association with almost like lasciviousness and lust with Freya, so there's this kind of like Freya is an extremely sexual goddess, but the associations there are not quite with the procreative or romantic or softer side of Venus or the Venusian idea that people associate with it. And then it gets into problems of, and I think this translates to other cultures and pantheons, but I don't have much expertise outside of this particular culture. And that is, like, to pre-Christian Nordic people, these weren't gods of things, right? Like, the I know there's the association of Thor with thunder, but I think that could be looked at in a poetic sense of, like, the thunder is Thor. And there's a whole bunch of private cults of ancestor worship that get obfuscated when we extrapolate religion from the poems that we have, because in many cases Freya wasn't like the god of something. Freya was a mythic ancestor or was the god of a place, or the goddess associated with a specific tract of land that generations of families or a farmstead lived on. So I suspect that there were more private cults happening where certain names of deities were more titles associated to ancestor cults. They weren't necessarily like the public religion of like, this is the father. And I almost started naming off the seven gods from George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones, because I think that's a good example of like, they weren't necessarily archetypes.
Yes, yes. No, I love this. That's so fascinating. I'd never thought about that before. But it would make sense because they weren't necessarily a homogenized society, like under one king, in the way that we think about like Europe, you know?
Right. Well, Neil Price has these really great, if your listeners just YouTube Neil Price, he has.
I'll put it in the show
notes.
Yes,
I will link it to you. He has great lectures up on YouTube, and he talks about, he's really into the Viking mind, and he's a Viking studies guy, and he's into this idea of like, how do the Vikings see themselves, and how do we interpret their self point of view, as opposed to how mm-hmm. we look at them from our point of view. And he has a really great lecture on Viking Age conceptions of death and death rituals, and it's really eye-opening when you realize we have modern ideas and myths around the Vikings believed that you died in battle and went to Valhalla and that was honorable, or you died and went to a sort of a purgatorial state. Or you went to like Folkvanger, the hall of Freya, if she selected you in battle. And the archaeological record shows that actually, Viking Age people believed a lot of things about death, a lot of different things about death. There's a whole taxonomy of different types of burials, and it's just as likely and probably more common. The Viking Age people believed that when you die, you go live in that hill over there where all your ancestors are buried, and you go live with them and the elves, right? Like, mm-hmm. And so we have a tendency to look at the Nordic stuff and say they believed this, when really there was a plurality and a polyvocality that gets erased in the kind of popular culture historical record.
Yeah. Can you correct me if I'm wrong about my understanding of the issue here with that? When I was looking it up, it looked like they were saying that there were actually a large number of different, like, you know, jobs and aspirations and like social society that went on like back in the Norse area. But the reason why it looks like it was all Vikings, all war, all Valhalla all the time is because most of the records that we have were written by the English, who were getting raided by the warrior class. Yeah. And so they were only making contact with one of the larger, like there was a much larger social system than what the English had a population sample of.
That's correct. And okay. I think what also goes into it, I mean, one of my gripes with the focus on Vikings at the detriment of all of the other stuff is the Viking Age was relatively short. It was a couple hundred years, right? And and when you zoom out, that's kind of a blip. But the other side of it is, yes, I think the sources are biased because you have the people being raided. But also, it's kind of sexy and interesting, and it's the easiest to sell, right? Like it's definitely the easiest to capture the popular imagination.
I mean, you ever watch Vikings and say to yourself, damn, what would have happened if the Norse religion had won? Like, what would the world look like, you know?
Well, from my point of view, it didn't need to win or lose because it's still accessible and true. And I do there. Yes, I especially when I was younger, I did have fantasies about what if my religion was the Like, what if we had churches, right? Like, what if it was acknowledged in public? Because I went to a school that was not officially Southern Baptist because it was a public school, but it was, the entire faculty were Southern Baptists, and that was difficult. Like, in the early 2000s in high school, it was almost dangerous to be an out pagan. And so I've definitely had that fantasy, but I suspect that the kind of good thing about the pop culture Viking stuff is it is leading to a revival, and it's really leading to this huge revival of interest. And that I think is key. The Vikings are fascinating and interesting, and they're a lot easier to sell than like farmers, just farmers. Though,
sure.
If you watch those first seasons of the Viking show, it fascinates me how much people miss the point that Ragnar, who actually, his celebrated day is my birthday, March 28th, Ragnar Lothbrok Day. It's the day they celebrate him sailing into and sacking Paris. But Ragnar in Vikings really just wants to find a good settlement with good soil so he can set up good farmland for his people and his family, right? Like, and all of the violence and the like the macho-ness is not really the point for him. It's like this necessary evil that he's trying to like retire from, and the tragedy is that he just never can.
Well, yeah, I mean, the tragedy to me of that whole thing was the inability for the two cultures to reconcile a compassion for each other, just because because of the way that their mythonarrative structured the political sphere differently, the way that they viewed right and wrong was completely different. And that
right.
inevitably led to irreconcilable differences. Mm-hmm. I didn't even view it as like Ragnar trying to be macho. I just viewed it as him enacting out like the mythonarrative of his god. You yeah. know?
Wow.
And that to me was like, oh my gosh, what was the monk's name?
Oh, I can't remember it, but I know
whatever.
What you're talking about. The monk. His monk buddy.
Yeah, that was kind of
Athelstan,
cute, I guess.
I think.
Athelstan, yeah. Yes, that was his name. And his whole thing was like, his mytho-narrative was being that like self-sacrificed, you know, I'm humble, I'm meek, I just listen, you yeah. know, in the very beginning. And then he like starts to move into his Odin as he's like listening to the stories and like going into these lived experiences of their like ecstatic dances in the woods. And he's like, right. Oh, I get it now. Because when you live a different myth, when you give your, and you know this also as a Thelemite, because I think this is kind of like what Crowley was getting at when he was like, you wear different masks. You know, when you change your mythos and your like mythological narrative and you start like accepting, well, instead of viewing the Allfather as this like detached like judger of good and evil that like wants me to be like weirdly pure and never tap into like my animalistic nature.
Right.
You know, view it as this like. I don't know. You tell me the qualities of Odin. I don't know them as well.
Incessantly wisdom seeking, the driver and ground of poetic ecstasy, including frenzy. That's how I would describe Odin.
Oh, I love that so much.
Yeah. You know, there's a really neat god that shows up in, I think it might be in only Snorri's work, maybe it's in the Elder Edda as well, named Hermod, who is sent by Odin, older is frenzy, right? That's and that's rooted in Odin's name, but is also I believe it's Freya's husband. I'm not actually very big on lore, right? Like on mythic lore, because people get really hung up on it, and so I try not to play those games of like memorizing too much about the myth to prove like, okay, I know this, right? But Hermod is strange as a deity who pops up in the poems, because he's the messenger who's sent by Odin down to Hel, the realm that's overseen by the goddess Hela, when Baldur, his son, has died, and he sends this messenger deity down to check in on him. And the name there, right, Hermod, is a little bit too neatly close to Hermes as a messenger and psychopomp. Like it's neat how that just pops up there. Though I have my own wacky theory about Middle Eastern roots that influenced Nordic religion, like with Baldur, right? His wife's name is Nanna, and it seems to fit almost too neatly with Inanna and Baal. Mm-hmm. And then these may be spurious, but some of my best theories of like the birth of especially the Aesir and that pantheon in Nordic religion really does seem to come from the Mediterranean and Middle East and the Asia Minor and Turkey area, which I say is like another way of also addressing the stupidity of like racists and bigots who try to jump into this stuff as some form of like pure white religion, because it's not, and that doesn't make sense. But then again, none of their beliefs make sense, so it tracks.
Well, that was actually why it took me so long to have someone on the podcast to talk about this subject. Like,
yeah, it's a problem.
Kind of a minefield, yeah, but of no fault to the gods or to the runes or to the magic of which it speaks. So there's a whole complex historical reason why it's a minefield, you know?
There is. And this is another reason why confronting reality with one's eyes wide open and being very mindful and aware of where fantasy starts and reality ends is necessary, especially as a rune magician, because the history, it cannot be avoided. It must be addressed. The history of runic magic involves German Romanticism that births a Nazi occultism and then neo-Nazi occultism. And that is a thing that exists that people have done. I believe that it is a gross misappropriation and sacrilege. But that being said, there have been horrible people, fascists and bigots, who have used runes. And I believe that the birth of that usage and appropriation of what to me is sacred is born out of certain fantasies, right? And certain glamours. Glamours and fantasies around racial purity, around like nationhood, and in some case manliness and stuff, and those are also reasons why it's important to me to say like, okay, rune magicians have a responsibility to dispel those kinds of fantasies.
So in this case, because earlier you were saying like when you want to stay grounded, like use runes to, you know, hack your programming to stay grounded. But in this case, I do feel like it's poignant to say that, like, if you educate yourself on the history of a situation, mm-hmm. like, if you actually take the time to, like, read academic papers, and I know we're talking about poetry, we're talking about singing and carving bones and then dipping the bones in blood.
Yes.
Okay, so read academic papers as an anchor, ground yourself in the actual history of, like, why these things are tied together. I mean, I'm... like, coming from a person who has very loud Jewish ancestors on one side and very loud Viking ancestors on the other side, you know, like, you can have both. Like, you don't have to have anti-Semitism in your rune magic. I don't do rune magic yet, but,
yeah.
you know, I'm going to, and it's going to be fine.
Well,
you know, and so you can do it too, is all I'm saying.
And... in fact, I believe that maybe not necessarily the runes. The best academic arguments I've seen for the origin of the runes are from Italic scripts and the influence of Rome and the Roman world, but possibly also maybe Etruscan or Phoenician influences.
I just mean like educate yourself on like the reason why all of that racial purity originally got tied to the Norse deities is because that's something that Hitler actually was saying.
Yeah.
And like, for example, I did not know that. Like, I literally did. And like, I had, again, like Jewish, and I did not know that. And so like, that's the kind of stuff that can like hit you with the ground of reality, you know? It's like, I'm not even saying like trace the whole history of anti-Semitism, but like if you learn the origin points of, or you could trace the entire history of anti-Semitism, that'll definitely give you a dose of reality. And I do think that more magicians should do that, especially, you know, knocking on the other, you know, proverbial, like potentially transgressive wood, but Thelemites could study the anti-Semitism history as well. And it's just like,
absolutely,
microdose yourself with a little bit of reality. Like that'll put some humility on your shoulders. You
right.
know what I'm saying?
And my approach is to macrodose with reality. I think we shouldn't shy away from it. I think we should look at it with our eyes open and acknowledge it and do better. Though that sounds like bad HR language. When I say that, I suddenly think about really bad press releases. And I mean, same with Crowley, right? Like, we should look at and acknowledge anti-Semitic and misogynistic things Crowley said.
Yes,
we should
exactly.
look at and acknowledge and fight. Uses of runes and Nordic motifs and religious motifs on the part of fascists and racists and Nazis. And, you know, I'm curious, you also make a good point, because my approach has been like to look at the Nazis and go, look at them, they did it wrong, this is why they're wrong, and like let's like acknowledge this and very loudly acknowledge this, right? Like this is something that happened. We can't dance around it, and let's like say fuck that, right? But you also bring up like, okay, let's trace anti-Semitism too, and that's not something I have thought about too much in this context, right? By which I mean in the context of like how do you do runes and do them in a way that dispels the curse and the glamour that started with German Romanticism and boomed with the Nazis. But I am curious to hear about what has you kind of interested in the runes, right? Because you reached out to me because you wanted to talk about them. And you just mentioned that you have some intent to work with them. And I'm curious to hear what brought you to this point. And if what feelings you do have as somebody who has Jewish ancestry too.
Well, I think, you know, it's one of those things where, like, Holly Young was one of the first bands that I ever did magic, like real magic to, like not that cosplay shit, but like real yeah. magic. And like, that was the moment that I was like, oh shit, okay. And opened a path, started, it's, that was like the thing that started everything. And so there's always been a part of me that's like known, okay, that is like a part of something that's connected to me. But I actually have avoided it for the aforementioned reasons. Like,
that makes sense. Yeah,
I mean, especially because the next thing that I did was throw myself into Kabbalah and like resurgence of like Jewish Kabbalah, you know, like, you know, the magic of my ancestors, you know, yeah. and like returning to that. And still avoiding the Norse stuff, because then it's like I'm trying, you know, community online, and I know I have spent enough time in left circles. Like, I was really involved in left circles before I was involved in magic, so I know what the dog whistles are. So I was just like, okay, well, I'm not participating with you people, I guess. So it just wasn't really in my circle. It just wasn't really ever around, you know?
That makes a lot of sense.
But it just kept coming, you know, like it just kept popping up. I can't explain it. If you do magic, if you're a person that's like involved in spirit work, you know what I'm talking about. Like, when a spirit or a deity like wants your attention, they'll get your attention. Right. So just, and that has actually been, and it has been so enormously loud lately. Like, it's actually really funny. When I hit you up, it wasn't nearly as loud as it has been leading up to today, when like we are recording. Like, I've had multiple syncs with it
right.
today. But of course, I was listening to Holly Young earlier today. So then it's like, so who's really syncing who? Because yeah. I do listen to Holly Young a lot. I will acknowledge that.
you're calling them in. I mean, they even have that song where they recite the 16 runes
exactly,
from the younger
yeah.
Futhark and the poems, I think, in Old Norse.
And I've seen them twice.
Wow.
I've seen them live twice. And both times were like weirdly important Sati Sati related transits. So that's like a Saturn related transit. So it was just interesting how that synced up.
If my work in the world has any impact that I can be proud of one day, I certainly hope that I help create more avenues of engagement with the runes and more space for people to work with runes, free of the context of contemporary organized heathenry or Nordic paganism. Because I feel that the runes can be approached as a complete system in and of themselves, and that they exist outside of heathenry, right? That or at least heathenry can be encompassed by runes, but you can approach them outside of the context of heathenry, and you don't have to be a Nordic pagan to work with runes and to engage with their mysteries and to receive benefit and blessings and wisdom from them. And you don't have to be into Viking stuff. they are there and out there for everyone. I'm partial to Odin as a god, and I feel that Odin is a truly universal god, but you don't have to be into Odin to work with runes. Like, Odin did not make the runes. They just are there. And it helps. There's these complex Nordic, Norse, Old Norse conceptions of the soul and various sheaths that form astral bodies and things that look kind of like karma that are inherited from our ancestors. Learning that system, I like to just call it soulcraft, right? That may be an ahistoric term, but learning the kind of the Old Norse soulcraft stuff. That can help understand the metaphysics of the runes, but I hope that I can do work in the world to help create more space for the runes in and of themselves as something that people can work with magically and not feel compelled to have to. It's not that those spaces are necessarily bad. There's the problems that you mentioned, right? That are clear. There are dog whistles. Mm-hmm. That you're gonna run into racists.
And it's insidious, right? Like, that's how a dog whistle works.
Right. And I just don't like the... I don't want to speak in negativity. For me, I find that a lot of it is... there's often... As somebody who grew up in the religion, I find that a lot of those spaces have many people who are coming from... you know, a Christian background that they're a little bit disaffected with, but often in the organized context, bring their Christian baggage with them and sort of reskin it and re-theme mm-hmm. it around the Viking stuff or the Norse stuff, and but still bring the church with them, if you get what I'm saying. And so those spaces are not my comfiest, coziest spaces. That being said, I've also met many heathen kindreds that were wonderful to hang out with. So I hope, as people are listening to this, that they don't uninvite me from their parties, because I still want to drink mead from a drinking horn with you. I want to hang out with you. And if you're hearing this and you have a kindred, please come party with me. I will do that if you're cool and you're not a racist.
Yeah, I'll disclaimer as well, just for a minute, just any and all of this, you know, we're talking about an overarching problem within a social community. We're not talking about any one person in a community. You can be involved in the community and you can not be, you know, it's not like cops. You're not all bad apples. It's yes, not that bad of a social
I
system.
Guess. Wait, cops is maybe your words, not mine. Mikayla, you are much more articulate than I am, though. It's I feel like I'm...
Oh, that's just a Gemini in my chart. Don't worry. I just got that Mercury helping me out a little bit.
Understood. But I, if I'm working towards anything with like Vitki Arts, it's to create more space for people to engage with the runes outside of the obligation to be a heathen or to be in like organized heathenry. And so hearing your interest in hearing some of the roadblocks to your journey there, I do hope that you pick them up, and if they resonate with you, that they bring you blessings, right? That they bring you wisdom and expand the purview of your life.
I appreciate that so much, Phil. I really do. I'm actually definitely going to take your class
when it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to take the advice that you gave, and I will start astrally meditating on the runes and see what mysteries they open up for me. And it'll be beautiful, I'm sure, and maybe a little scary sometimes, I hope.
Oh, yes. Definitely both.
Yeah, I'm excited. This was great. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thank
you.
This
was amazing.
And the class that I semi-regularly teach is called Approaching the Runes, which I think is an important title because and I think it can help you and can help people that might have a similar call to runes, but the same concerns. Which is, I try not to teach meaning. I try to teach pathways and means of approaching the runes to have your own experience with them. And I think that's the best way to get the stuff out of it that I think you want.
Yes, definitely. And I totally just letting the podcast world know, I will be informing people on Instagram probably through my stories whenever that class does happen again. So just be on the lookout for that if runes are, or follow Phil at Vitki Art and he will inform you.
Yeah, it's plural. Vitki Arts, plural.
Vitki Arts, plural. I got you. I'm sorry
Thank
about
you.
That.
That's okay. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, yeah, this was a joy. I'm looking forward to it. And maybe I'll have you on another time and we'll actually talk about some of the like syncretism, the lema stuff.
I would love that. You're so thoughtful, so articulate. You've put certain thoughts that I've had in much better words than I can put them. And I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoy every moment of the shared co-creative experience. And that if that can be a part of the exchange that I bring to the table, then that brings me joy.